From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
With the sheer number of those who won't get vaccinated because of their faith, some doctors fear it could be a major problem for the country's effort to reach herd immunity.
The general number is about 80%. That's a big number to obtain, and we need everybody on board to get to that level.
One of the most effective ways to motivate Americans is through the words of faith leaders. But it's also one of the most effective ways to demotivate them as well. And we're seeing plenty of that in the stalled vaccination rates in this country. Even as the latest strain of COVID-19 continues to rapidly spread, working to organize a moral call for responsible action on this critical issue is the organization Faith in Public Life, and Executive Director Jennifer Butler will be back with us to discuss this urgent initiative.
That as we look back on the 25 years and how far we've come and how far we have moved into public spaces and out of being a small vocal minority, protecting a small vocal minority of neighbors. And I think we're remarkably set up after the first 25 years to take on the next 25.
This month, Interfaith Alliance of Iowa is celebrating 25 years of committed activism, protecting true religious freedom for all. We'll look back and ahead with longtime Executive Director Connie Ryan.
The focus is on mosque activities, issues of women in the mosque, and also kind of attitudes of mosque leaders. Attitudes in regards to how they understand Islam, what we call Islamic approach, but also attitudes in terms of how they view involvement in America and how they view America in general.
The Institute for Social Policy and Understanding continues the important work of analyzing the results of its wide-ranging American Mosque Survey. Primary investigator Ison Bagby will be back with us again with findings from the second report.
I'm Ray Kirstein, reporting from the intersection of religion, government, and how different people define acting as Christians. A study by Reuters of recent Supreme Court emergency actions, where decisions are made without oral arguments or clarifying writings from the justices, reveals 10 out of 10 cases brought by religious applicants led to a win every time. Notably, every one of these involved demands for exemption from public health restrictions around COVID-19. Meanwhile, during the emotional hearings on the January 6th Capitol riot, a Capitol police officer testified that the attackers were, in his words, quote, terrorists who perceived themselves to be Christians, end quote. He understood them to be acting in the name of God and of Donald Trump. And 56 years after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. led clergy people on the march to Selma, Alabama, in the fight for voting rights, Poor People's Campaign co-chair William Barber II is leading a similar group on a four-day voting rights march to Austin, Texas. The Moral March for Democracy set off on Wednesday, July 27th, in scorching climate crisis-era heat.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. If you haven't done it, do it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, and some of you have, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest. The Reverend Jennifer Butler has been an effective leader of the nonprofit Faith in Public Life since its founding in 2008, organizing around critical issues of justice and religious values, And bringing together faith leaders, activists, and diverse people of faith to work for change. The ongoing COVID crisis is revealing both positive and negative impacts moral leaders can have on rates of vaccination, and faith in public life is out front working to increase the positive side of that equation. Back with us today is my good friend, Reverend Jennifer Butler. Jennifer, thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Wilton.
So where are you seeing the greatest opportunity for reducing vaccine hesitancy?
Well, the highest rate of hesitancy in the country is among white Christian evangelicals. And so it's really important that church leaders begin speaking out. And so organizing a sort of counter response among trusted leaders with accurate information and religious messaging around taking care of our neighbors and loving one another is really critical at this moment in time where the Delta variant is causing the pandemic to resurge.
Do you find that medical, moral, or mixed messaging is most likely to be effective?
You know, I think the most important thing is that these folks who are doubtful really hear from people they trust. Our society has gotten so polarized. In fact, it has been polarized by elected leaders, by politicians, and by corporations that are funding misinformation campaigns, that really the only way to break through these days is through friends, family, pastors, people who are insiders to the community, who are really well trusted, and through multiple conversations.
There are denominations that are dead set against encouraging their congregants to be vaccinated. The last figure I saw, and you may have a different one, was 47% of white evangelicals have said that they will not take the vaccine. So are there ways to differentiate between sincere dogma and the political strain of resistance and denial that seems to permeate the evangelical community in particular?
Yeah, this is so difficult because there have been past eras where conservative Christians may have led on an issue like this as kind of a law and order issue even. And so it's quite ironic that they are kind of buying into this kind of disorganized response to the pandemic. And we see the ways in which our politics right now, particularly the politics of our prior president and how he mismanaged the pandemic, is really leading evangelicals, white evangelicals, to respond in this way. And then, of course, we have the problem of our news media and conspiracy theories that are running rife on the internet. So this is a politicized issue. I mean, it's historic. There's some roots in our history around, you know, how Christians respond to science. But we have to recognize that the issue has been politicized. And so, you know, I guess I should say, in addition to religious leaders continuing to try to reach folks, our political leaders should be trying to reach them as well, particularly those identified with the Republican Party.
You know, I couldn't help but think as I was reading some of these figures that people who are, I think, trying to make a decision about this, I would recommend to them your latest book on Who Stole My Bible. and read that and put that together. It might be a really helpful thing.
I think so. Yeah, you know, because what we have here is an authoritarian leader, and the Bible says, you know, who perpetuated these kinds of misinformation campaigns, and you know, Christians. The Bible is very clear that we as Christians need not be beholden to tyrants, need not create an idol of our political leaders, need to understand them as human beings, and often sinful human beings. And so we should be questioning leaders who spread misinformation.
Well, and I think it's good to say that Jesus was very interested in people being healthy.
That's right. Jesus healed the sick, and Jesus debunked the misinformation campaigns of his day that said that people were sick as a result of their own actions. He was constantly questioning, you know, authorities and showing compassion to others, and really put care of neighbor at the top of the list in terms of how we should live our lives.
Yeah. There is a profound overlap between this group of conservative white Christians and the Republican Party. I confess, I'm disgusted with the large number of GOP politicians who outright refuse to say whether or not they themselves have been vaccinated, while at the same time openly calling on their followers to play Russian roulette with their lives and the lives of their loved ones. But it's happening. It's happening all over the country. In that kind of environment, how do you penetrate partisanship in terms of religion, morality, or anything else?
Yeah, this is so important. I think sometimes we as religious people underestimate the importance of our theological voice in public life and in society. And what has happened in this country is conservatives have been very vocal about claiming certain stances based on their faith and offering scriptural justification for those stances, this kind of opposition to science, for example. And instead, you know, I think what we need to be about is more progressive Christians is really grounding our conversations in scriptural backing. We understand the Bible in a whole different way. And I think that can be helpful for those who are looking to remain faithful, think that they are being faithful by following the lead of these politicians who claim to be Christian, but who are some of the most unchristian we've ever seen. Yeah. And so I would encourage people, and this is again why I wrote this book, Who Stole My Bible? Because we need to reclaim scripture as a handbook for resisting tyrants and resisting misinformation campaigns. And so I think for those of us who have friends and family, and I certainly do, who've been caught up in these misinformation tactics, yeah. I think really talking about our values in a very inclusive and compassionate way, helping lead people through that kind of wilderness journey of coming out of a fundamentalist faith can be very, very helpful.
Where are you seeing progress being made on this, if you are seeing progress?
Well, I've seen there's a campaign, Christians for the Vaccine, that's being led by a friend of mine, actually, Curtis Chang. And I've seen some prominent pastors stepping up and stepping out. And I think as people take in the gravity of this, I think even, you know, a handful of prominent white Christian pastors can really be game changers, because I think what we need is someone to lay the foundation and the groundwork, and then hopefully there'll be a snowballing effect. Mm-hmm. And they've really got to begin those conversations now. And it really takes multiple conversations, because people are so indoctrinated. And I've heard pastors often say, you know, I have them a couple of times a week. If you're in an evangelical church, people go to church all week long. Yeah. But Fox News has them 24/7. And then, of course, there are all these internet misinformation campaigns going on as well. I've even heard of misinformation campaigns penetrating churches and sort of destabilizing the leadership of a church. Yeah. And so there's some stealth tactics kind of happening within congregations themselves. So, you know, a lot of pastors, those pastors who do stand up, I think, you know, need support and need backing from allies in their community. So maybe those of us who are pastors in certain communities that are really impacted could do, you know, some outreach to evangelical colleagues just to offer support in this time.
I'd like for you to talk about tactics that our listeners can employ in their daily lives to perhaps help chip away at vaccine resistance in their own communities and networks.
Yeah, I mean, I think one, you know, if you are in a position, reach out. I've often found that more conservative pastors, we write them off sometimes, but they actually are really open to dialogue and coalition building. We've certainly done that around LGBTQ issues with great success. I think with our friends and family members, which is the question I get the most when I'm talking about my book, you know, how do we talk to those who've really been pulled in to these channels? I've been using a, I think it was Quaker-based, used during the LGBTQ equality movement to have dialogues. It's called a process called CLARA. That's an acronym. The C stands for center, center yourself, because we really need to be grounded. When we have these conversations, it's easy to get angry and frustrated and alarmed, but we need to stay calm. We need to listen, really understand what the person is saying, and show some empathy for what's going on, because people, there's a lot of reason to be afraid right now. So really try to empathize, even if you don't understand what they're, or agree with what they're saying, try to show some empathy for the feelings. Affirm, find something you can affirm. And often that is just sort of like, I hear you're really afraid right now and really concerned and it's hard to know who to trust. And then respond directly, address the concerns that they have and continue to add more information and anecdotes. You know, having that kind of a conversation over and over again, but just really trying to maintain trust and empathy is really important, and to really kind of, you know, just stay in that place of staying centered with people. Yeah. So they have a place to go with questions.
Is there any other resource you want to mention that's available from Faith in Public Life or your partners?
Related to this, I produced a guide on QAnon as well that is on my author website, you know, ReverendJimButler.com. And I think some of what I write about in there can be applied to COVID vaccine hesitancy. We right now are prioritizing communities of color, and really they have a different dynamic around the COVID vaccine. I mean, they have been the target in the past of medical experimentation and racially motivated racist medical policies. And so their trust comes from a very different place than white evangelical trust. Yeah. And then sometimes it's just plain lack of access and disparities in healthcare that prevent them from getting vaccinated. And so we're also encouraging, you know, some real outreach in those communities, and we can provide support there if anybody's looking for that support in communities of color.
How can our listeners learn more about your work and how they can support that work?
Thank you. Well, they can sign up. It'd be great if you all sign up at www.faithinpubliclife.org for our advocacy list, because we need to mobilize across this country around these issues as they arise, around protecting our democracy, around economic equality, around anti-racism efforts, and certainly the COVID pandemic. And what we provide is some ongoing support and rapid response according to the areas where people live, so that you can really get engaged and make a difference in a way that's really doable and teaming up with other religious leaders.
Reverend Jennifer Butler is the founding executive director of Faith in Public Life and the author, most recently, of the book, Who Stole My Bible? Reclaiming Scripture as a Handbook for Resisting Tyranny. Jennifer, I know you're busy, but I sure do thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's such an honor and a pleasure to join you, Elton. Thank you.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Interfaith Alliance of Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan. And later, the second report of the American Mosque Survey from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Later this month, Interfaith Alliance of Iowa is celebrating its silver anniversary. Active almost as long as the National Interfaith Alliance itself, the Iowa affiliate has many achievements to be proud of, and many ongoing initiatives to stay busy for the next 25 years. Joining me now is the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa Executive Director, Connie Ryan. Connie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It is a pleasure always to talk with you.
How did the Iowa Interfaith Alliance get started?
Well, there was a school board election in Des Moines, Iowa in 1995, and there was a sitting school board member who was known to his family and friends as his sexuality of being a gay man. And that became the issue of his reelection when the religious right came in and kind of swept into Des Moines and challenged him, not because of the things that he had accomplished or not accomplished on the school board, but simply because of his sexuality, and used all kinds of rhetoric. You can imagine what that was back in those days. And our school board elections are very short, and so there was not time to really organize around that and put a different narrative out there. And so he was defeated after having been on the school board for 12 years, simply because he is a gay man. And there was a group of folks who said that is wrong and that they believe differently from their faith than the religious right. And they, long story short, they organized and eventually created Interfaith Alliance of Iowa out of that contentious school board election.
Mm. So what has been your involvement personally over the years?
I started off actually as a student practicum, and then they asked me to stay and be the executive director. The work that we have done has been phenomenal, I think, in the growth of the organization. I started off part-time, eventually became full-time. We've now added two more staff. We do things very, very carefully and thoughtfully based on our mission and in our work. We, of course, continue to do work around LGBTQ rights, but we have added a broad spectrum of issues and concerns when it comes to challenging extremism, especially around hate, bigotry, and violence. Those are things that we care deeply about. But we also do a tremendous amount of work of protecting public schools, racial justice work, immigration reform, gun safety, gun violence prevention, those kind of things. And so we have just grown exponentially, both in our work and our reach throughout the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Why was it important for you when you took the job? Why was it important for you to engage with these particular issues? And what has kept you motivated and committed all these years?
What was really important for me was that combination of politics and my faith, really, and being able to do this work because of my faith. I grew up in a household with two clergy persons as my parents, and we always talked about politics, and we always talked about that intersection of what our faith really drives us to do. And so it was not a foreign thing at all for me to have the conversations at the dinner table, even of around religion and politics. And so a lot of the issues that we work on are about civil rights for people who have been marginalized. And that is very near and dear to my heart because of people that I know, but also just my care and my passion that people should be treated fairly and equitably and given every opportunity to shine in their lives. And so I think that we've had a great platform, and this has given me a platform to do the things that I want to do and the things that I'm passionate about.
Connie, do you think that the same themes that we've been working on all these years will hold true to other activists and supporters there in Iowa? Are they looking at the same things you're looking at?
You know, you know, you've been in this business a long time also, Welton, and we are seeing some of the same things come around again. Some of the fights that we had back in the 1990s, particularly targeted at the LGBTQ plus community, is now coming back around. Some of the same rhetoric when we're doing the work on racial justice issues, and we're seeing some of the same tropes that are coming around. There will always be a group of people who are marginalized. There will always be a group of people who are attacked because of who they are, whom they love, their skin color, their immigration status, whatever it is. In our country, we're pretty good at marginalizing people. And so the voice of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, the voice of Interfaith Alliance, will always be important in these conversations because it brings a different perspective than sometimes what is heard in the public square.
Connie, what would you say are two or three of the most notable achievements or ongoing programs at Interfaith Alliance of Iowa?
So I would list a couple of different things that are our most notable accomplishments. We were a key ally partner in the work around marriage equality before marriage equality happened. You know, Iowa was the third state, the first in the Midwest to have marriage equality with the Varnum decision in 2009. But we were already doing work starting in about 2005, and then very intentionally having quiet conversations, as you used to talk about, with faith leaders of how they could engage in these conversations in their faith community. And we began that work in 2007. And so I'm very proud of the work that we did around that, even before the Varnum decision, and always in partnership with the LGBTQ community and the lead organizations in the state on those issues. That was important work to us. It's not that we may have marriage equality in Iowa, we may have marriage equality in the United States, but there's much more work to do to make sure that our brothers and sisters who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and more, that they have all the rights that everyone else does and are treated equitably, fairly, and with respect and dignity. So that's a big piece of our work. Another piece of our work is always working in coalition. I can't think of an issue that we work on that we're not working with other organizations, with other groups, with other stakeholders on an issue, whether that is gun safety and gun violence prevention, or whether that is immigration work, or whether that is our newly started racial justice work that we began really intentionally after George Floyd was murdered, and working with faith leaders across the state on that. We always work in coalition, and because we do that, we have strong relationships with a broad spectrum of groups, from civil rights to business to labor, et cetera. And then the third piece I would name is our public policy work at the legislature. We have a presence and have had a presence since 2005 at the legislature. In 2011, I began lobbying and am there full time during the legislative session, although not this past year, as you can predict. But we have been working in partnership, again, with all of those allied groups. We have had tremendous impact in public policy, sometimes moving things through, but more often stopping things. And that has been important work.
Personally, what's the most satisfying thing about doing this work?
Well, I wasn't expecting that question, but it really is working with different people across the state. I love engaging in the work at that individual level and small group level, getting to know folks. We've had the opportunity in the last year, I mentioned our racial justice work, and COVID actually gave us an opportunity to meet different people around the state in a different way because of Zoom. And some folks that we may not have built relationships with. And for me, that is at the core of the work. When we're building relationships and having an impact on key issues that really impact people at the ground level, that is very rewarding. And It's what brings me hope, and why I stay in this work is because of the relationships that I have built personally, mm-hmm. and that we have built as an organization.
Connie, who are some of the other folks who have made this 25th anniversary possible?
We have a whole team. First of all, you know, our board of directors, we have two boards for the Action Fund and then for Interfaith Alliance of Iowa. And they are all hands on, I have always had just wonderful board members, and kudos to them for the commitment they have to the organization. And then on our staff team, I also have Kristen Clark, who's been with us for about 6-7 years as the administrative and communications person, and Bridget Fagan Reedburn, who is our newest staff person. She's been here 3 years as the development person. I have to give a shout out from the very beginning of the organization, Alicia Claypool, who is still working hard for all of the justice issues that really matter. And she has been a key partner always in the work that we do. On our website, you can find a couple of videos, and there will be a third video that goes up. And so we've partnered with a videographer to talk about our story and to tell our story. And so we have two, one from the very beginnings, one around our coalition work, and one on our public voice in the public square. And that tells a lot of our story, and some just really good partners that have always been supportive of our work and our work together.
Tell her hello, please. I'd like to have a conversation with her, too. As you look forward, what are the likely priorities going to be in the months and years ahead as you look at it?
I would say a couple of things. We're going to continue the racial justice work that we initiated last year, and that has become an important piece of the work that we do in making sure that we bring the progressive voice of faith and no faith into that conversation and engaging people, particularly in rural Iowa. And because we hear oftentimes, well, there aren't any Black people here, why should I care about racial justice work? Well, there's lots of reasons why you should care about that. And so we're going to continue that work. Our legislative work is ongoing, and not just during the legislative session. And we have turned into a very conservative state over the last few years. And so that has been hugely challenging. And we will continue to bring that progressive voice and work with our partner organizations, really making sure that there is always that religious voice, progressive voice in the public square, pushing back on the extremism that we are seeing in our state and beyond. Mm-hmm. And then I would add also some work around our courts. We continue to do work in that area and making sure that we have fair and impartial courts in our state and working with partner organizations mm-hmm. on that.
Connie, I want to go back to the celebration again. Talk about, if you would, the ways that you all are celebrating this 25th anniversary for Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, in particular the awards dinner on Monday, August 30th.
Yeah, we have really kind of planned out several things this year, and the award dinner is the biggest piece of that. And we have an annual award dinner. Last year it was virtual, but we are back to in person with a live stream option for those who don't feel comfortable. And it really is going to be a wonderful celebration. We'll be honoring a pastor here in Des Moines, and we'll be honoring One Iowa, which is the largest LGBTQ organization in the state, for their work, and an important ally organization with us. And then we're also going to be honoring Des Moines Public Schools and the challenges, meeting the challenges that have happened over the last year, not only in terms of COVID, but some other internal kind of things. And but we also have three featured speakers, and they really are community leaders in the state that instead of bringing a keynote speaker in, we decided to feature some of our local rock stars. And so that's going to be exciting. And, you know, we'll have several hundred people in the room, you know, all COVID protocols, all of that in place. But it really will be a celebration of the last 25 years, but also looking toward the future. Part of what we're wanting to do is using this as a catalyst, a jumping off place for the future work that we want to do, particularly around the state and in rural Iowa. Those are some of the goals that we have as an organization. Other things that we've done, I talked about the videos that really feature the work that we have done, but also telling our story is another piece of that. So each week we have a weekly e-newsletter, and each week we're featuring a different person that has been an important piece of the puzzle in the work that we have done. So it's not just about staff. It is about the people who are engaged in this work around the state.
One last question, and it is an important one. As you know, on State of Belief, we often encourage listeners to think about whether affiliating with Interfaith Alliance is something they might want to do in their own communities. I think that may sound like a daunting task, but like everything else, it's a matter of taking it one step at a time. I think you're in a unique position for encouraging folks who might see the need for this kind of work around them and don't think they've qualified or will be qualified to take action. What would you say to those people?
You know, I would say just take the chance and jump in. If you are seeing in your community, whether it is a town or a county, a region or a state, and you are seeing that the religious right or the extremist voices have an exponentially higher level of influence in your area, and you want to make sure that there is also a balancing progressive voice in the public square and that that is needed in your community, take a chance and jump in, talk with Jay Keller or Jack Moline at Interfaith Alliance, and they can steer you right. I am always happy to talk with folks who are interested in the work. I am not clergy. You don't have to be clergy to do this work, but what you have to have is a passion for religious freedom and making sure religious freedom is not being used to harm other people. You have a passion for people's civil rights and issues of equality and equity, and you have a passion for making sure the progressive voice is out there in the public square and representing those voices that matter and representing people who don't always have the ability to have their voice in the public square. So if you feel like there's a place for it, then absolutely do that. Do the work. It's important work. And there's lots of people to support you and encourage you.
Connie Ryan is the longtime executive director of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa. She is a really good friend. She's celebrating its 25th anniversary this month. We'll link to the details of the awards dinner celebration from stateofbelief.com. Connie, happy anniversary, and thanks as always for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton. I really appreciate the opportunity and love always talking with you.
Earlier this summer, we brought you the initial findings of the 2020 American Mosque Survey, courtesy of the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. The second report from this comprehensive survey is now out, and I am happy to welcome primary investigator Ison Bagby back to State of Belief Radio with the details. Ison, welcome back to the show.
Reverend Caddy, it's always good to be with you.
What's the focus of this second set of findings?
The focus is on mosque activities in particular. There is a very deep concern about issues of women in the mosque, but that also encompasses part of it, and also kind of attitudes of mosque leaders. Attitudes in regards to how they understand Islam, what we call Islamic approach, but also attitudes in terms of how they view involvement in America and how they view America in general. So those are the main aspects of the second report.
This gets into some of the mechanics of Islamic law decision-making. It's a topic that's rife with misunderstanding and malicious manipulation in public awareness, I'm sorry to say. What can people not versed in these topics learn from the findings of your work?
Well, the main headline in this regard is that the majority, 55%, of mosque leaders, and therefore the assumption that mosques themselves, take an Islamic, a moderate, if you will, Islamic approach, a flexible Islamic approach, a contextual approach, in the sense that they hold to the firm belief in the foundational text of Islam, the Quran. From the Muslim point of view, the revelation of from God to Muhammad, which is the holy book of Islam, and also the recorded sayings of Muhammad, that these two foundational texts are upheld by all the mosque leaders. But how do you interpret those texts? And the majority look upon these texts with an eye to modern circumstances, an eye to looking at the spirit of the law, the spirit of the text, as opposed to the letter, or not as opposed, but in addition to the letter of the text. So it is, from the Muslim point of view, this is a moderate approach. 45% basically have different ways of interpreting, but they look to the past. They look to great scholars, the legal schools of the past. And so it is a more, you know, traditional, from the Muslim point of view, a little bit more conservative view of the text. So, and this, the percentage of those who do look upon the text in a more flexible light, that percentage is increasing. Since 2000, it is steadily increasing.
So, in fact, does any part of Islamic law or Islamic beliefs conflict with participation in public life in a pluralistic democracy like ours?
Oh, not at all. In fact, even the conservative ones voice very loudly, clearly, with total consensus that Muslims should be involved in American society for the betterment of American society. And the reality is that is the opinion of Islamic law from classical times, from 1,000 years ago. The great scholars of Islam 1,000 years ago took the opinion, which was the consensus, that when Muslims are in other lands, they should be good contributors. They should be people who are bring benefit to the society that they live in. So that's not even a issue among Muslims. Basically, everybody agrees with that.
Yeah.
No mosque in our sample that we interviewed would hold the opinion that they want Sharia to take over American society, American law, that they want to impose Sharia. That is not the opinion of mosque leaders in America.
Is it fair to say that the majority of American Islamic leaders approach Muslim engagement in public life?
Yes. In fact, ever since we started, and when we started in 2000, I was actually surprised at the results. But since 2000, so even before 9/11, the vast majority of mosque leaders believed that Muslims should be involved in American society. And now that percentage, by the way, is up to 98% of mosque leaders believe that Muslims should be involved in civic institutions in America. 95% agree that Muslims should be involved in the political process in America. So there is no debate within the American Muslim community, within the mosque community, that Muslims need to be good contributors to American society, need to be involved in American society.
And involved in politics.
And involved in politics.
A vast majority of American mosques engage in interfaith activities. I obviously view that as a very positive thing indeed. What kinds of engagement did you find, and with whom are they primarily engaging?
Well, we asked about interfaith activities in three different respects. One, involvement in interfaith educational type activities. Secondly, involvement in interfaith community service type activities. And then thirdly, in worship activities. So over three-fourths of mosques are involved in interfaith educational type activities, dialogues and so forth. And over half, 59%, so about 60%, are involved in interfaith community service. Mm-hmm. A much lower percentage are involved in worship services, I think about 40%. Mm-hmm. Still a solid percent of people. So, I mean, there's one thing, and you probably know this from your own experience, that Muslims are willing interfaith partners. And the hope is that this interfaith dialoguing between Christian Jews and Muslims and others will continue to grow, because that's how we overcome prejudice, by getting to know one another. Mm-hmm. And that's the best predictor of a non-presidential discriminatory attitude towards the other, is when they know the other. When they get to know the other, they do not hold to the stereotypical prejudicial attitudes towards people.
I noticed the terminology "women-friendly mosques." I read some about that. One is, does that mean perhaps there are some that are not friendly with about women? And do the Muslim women want more engagement in the mosques than they're getting now?
Yeah. Well, you must remember, Reverend Gaddy, is that during the long centuries of Islam, and we're talking about a faith that started, well, let's say that Muhammad, of course, is the prophet of Islam. He lived well over 1,400 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in that long period, there developed the idea that became a consensus through those long centuries that women should not be participants in public life, and they should not have a presence in mosque. Mm-hmm. That became the long tradition. Mm-hmm. And so that is the tradition has been inherited, and that is the tradition that is being overturned, right. That is being changed, right?
Yes.
So you have this legacy that, in a sense, people are fighting against. Now, I must say, though, that it is not the legacy of the Prophet Muhammad. Mm-hmm. So here's the irony. During the time of Prophet Muhammad, women were welcomed in the mosque. Women right. were participants in yeah. the mission of Islam. So the argument of people that want to open up the mosque to women, to empower women, is not an argument we need to be like America or whatever. But no, we need to be like the Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah.
We need to go back to the real Islam,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So mosques in the Muslim world have little space for women, and women are not kind of part of the congregation in a sense. So that's changing. And so we have, recorded good progress in mm-hmm. these aspects.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
particular, women sitting on the mosque boards, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, that I noticed that. I noticed the that's becoming something that is in a lot of mosques. Yeah.
Right. So, for instance, in 2000, we did about one third did not even allow women.
Right.
On the board,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And now that's down to about 7%. So
yeah.
to me, it's clear that the argument that women should not be part of the decision-making of mosques no longer exists. That argument has been won mm-hmm. for the most part. And we need to see in a steady increase of women sitting on mm-hmm. mosque boards.
Yeah.
So there is good progress. The other aspect is the division of women from the prayer area, the main mm-hmm. prayer area, where they are completely secluded. And again, that is what has been inherited. That is the situation of the vast majority of mosques overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And that has not changed much.
Yeah.
So that is, in a sense, one of the main contentions in mm-hmm. mosques today. And but I expect to see, change along those lines, especially as the second generation. The Muslims
sure.
of America are still largely first-generation immigrants.
Right, yeah.
I mean...
Yeah.
Of course, there's a very sizable African-American and white American and Hispanic-American convert community, a significant percentage of the American Muslim community. But for the most part, they're first generation. And so the second generation, those Muslims who have been raised here, especially among the young women, are... kind of on the front lines of trying to change this reality in mosques where women are secluded.
Are there mm-hmm. areas of this second report that we need to look at specifically along lines of age groups or national origin?
Well, as a first generation, a largely first generation community, the American Muslim community is very young. So back in 2000 when we started, I don't know if I recorded any senior program.
Hmm.
Even in 2010, there are just a few. So in 2020, we recorded that 15% of mosques now have a senior program. And so this is the first blip mm-hmm. on the screen of a recognition that there are a growing number of seniors in the American Muslim community. So that's a phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the big headline from the first report, or one of the headlines, was that, we have a healthy participation of young adults.
Yes.
And but that's the biggest challenge as the American Muslim community moves forward is maintaining the participation of the young adults, because mm-hmm. there is significant grumbling among young adults.
Ison, what do you want everybody who listens to you today to know from this report? If they don't remember anything else that we've talked about, what do you want to be sure they remember?
The main thing is that mosques in America want to be neighbors to their community. Mm-hmm. They want to be contributors to the common good in their communities. They are not people who want to isolate. They are not haters. They are not trying to subvert America. And by the way, the first report showed that a significant number of mosques find resistance when they have to go to the zoning boards for expansion or new buildings, and that percentage is growing. So, but the reality is just the opposite, that Muslims are not trying to be some type of fifth column a wart on the skin of the community. No, they want to be a positive force in their community.
Dr. Ison Bagby is primary investigator for the American Mosque Survey 2020 from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. You can take a look at all of these findings at www.ispu.org, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Ison, thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, Reverend Gaddy, and God bless to you and all your listeners.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what?